On the second part of our program, we review another ASH CME satellite meeting, this time focusing on multiple myeloma. And for this symposium, the general medical oncologist on the stage with the faculty was Dr. Neil Morgenstein. I met with Dr. Irene Gobriel to go through the questions, issues, and cases raised related to upfront management of the disease. And to begin, we went through the very first case presented by Dr. Morgenstein, and I asked Dr. Gobriel for her take on the discussion. It was a 65-year-old man who was in what he described to be moderate health. The patient was a smoker, had hypertension, type 2 diabetes. He had a very good partial response to RVD, normal risk disease. He had a VGPR to RVD, and actually Dr. Morgenstein's question was, should he be transplanted? So his question was very straightforward, which is, you know, pretty much, is transplant standard of care, particularly for, you know, somebody kind of like this? Maybe you can talk a little bit about what your thoughts were about this case and about the whole issue of transplant nowadays.
So I think before ASH, we would have said we're not sure if transplant really gives us benefit or not, and whether we should be transplanting all our patients. We know that for many years there has been studies of transplant or no transplant, and this was with the old data, with the old studies. And then came along two large randomized studies, the French IFM and DFCI study, and we actually split them to be two different studies, each of them of around 1,000 patients or so. The Dana-Farber study is still ongoing, which is the large U.S. study. The French study was actually completed and presented in ASH this year. And before ASH, we were not sure whether transplant makes a difference. Now we know, at least from the French data, with RVD upfront, there is definitely a progression-free survival benefit of transplant. And that's in the large randomized study. There is no difference in the overall survival. I think we need to wait longer and see if those patients, as we follow them, there will be a difference in overall survival. But at least for now, PFS is truly different, that you have to transplant patients or at least offer them the transplant knowing this data now.
So yes, they did report in the immediate transplant group compared to the delayed, the PFS was 34 compared to 43 months with a hazard rate of 0.69. So it's kind of interesting, and we brought this up at the meeting, that the myeloma community, I find in general, is very quick to take action on PFS advantages without survival benefit. And, you know, general oncologists are used to thinking about survival. You know, this comes up in, you know, for example, rituximab maintenance and follicular lymphoma, comes up in breast cancer. The question of, you know, is PFS enough to justify treatment, particularly with a therapy that's not that easy to give. Is there any way to predict what you think eventually you're going to see with survival? And if it really truly turns out that in the long run there is no survival advantage, would you still favor transplant?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's true that in myeloma, we're using a lot the PFS as one of our endpoints. In fact, many of the drugs are being approved on PFS and not on overall survival. We think that probably we're not reaching overall survival differences because our patients are living longer. We have very good ways of salvaging them. So that's why we're not having those major differences. And indeed, PFS and the depth of response are truly good primary endpoints for us. I can't predict whether overall survival, there will be a difference or not. Remember, the French study stopped lenalidomide maintenance after 1 year, while here in the U.S., we're continuing on with lenalidomide maintenance in our patients long term. So that's one big difference where maybe we may see overall survival benefit here in the U.S. because we're continuing on with lenalidomide maintenance, while in the French one, everyone stopped after 1 year. However, that's pure speculation. We don't know until we see the actual data in the next few years to come.
So this turned out to be a pretty interesting case in that, unfortunately, this patient did not do well with a transplant. Specifically, he had neutropenic fevers, he developed C. diff, he had to go to rehab. And while in rehab, and again, keeping in mind he was a smoker with hypertension and diabetes, he had a cardiac event and died. And of course, you know, it's a terrible situation, particularly when you're not 100% convinced a therapy is indicated. How often do you see this? And people brought up the issue of him being a smoker. What do you think about this case?
Yeah, again, this is a very unfortunate situation here, but this is not the norm. In general, we think that the mortality rate with stem cell transplant, with autologous stem cell transplant in myeloma, is about 1%, and it's probably less than that with all the good care that's going on now. I would say that, yes, there is definitely a risk of death with everything, with all the treatment options we have. So I'm not sure that I would prevent someone from going on with transplant unless we, of course, talk about toxicity and risk and benefit. But I think here, in general, the risk of mortality for transplant is about 1%.
So Dr. Morgenstein had another case he wanted some input in, a 54-year-old man with normal standard risk myeloma, who achieved a VGPR with four cycles of pre-transplant RVD. And his question was, should therapy be extended to try to get a better response before transplant? What are your thoughts about that strategy?
Yeah, so I agree. I think that in general for trials, we're doing RVD for four cycles and then we transplant patients. Yet, you know that they may have not achieved the best response yet. And maybe if you give them two more cycles, they can achieve a depth of response and you can collect stem cells that are better with less contamination. Having said that, there has been so many studies in the old days saying that contamination doesn't matter and you can mobilize plasma cells and it's not what causes relapse for those patients. It's truly what's left over in the bone marrow of those patients. I think in general, by the time we're actually putting the patients for collection and so on, it's never exactly four cycles. It's usually five or six, and they're getting into their depth of response, and then we're collecting them after that. The other thing to be careful with is how long you stay on lenalidomide before you do the stem cell mobilization, because we know that len has a problem for mobilization. And that's why you're trying to keep it as short as possible. But it's not an absolute no-no for four cycles versus six versus longer.
So another case that was actually presented by this working group was an older patient, 77-year-old woman, standard risk disease, not a transplant candidate. Just basically getting into the generic question that this doc had about how you approach patients in this age group. And we saw kind of a split in both the faculty and the audience between two agents, mainly RD, or three agents, mainly RVD, really RVD light. What about the older patient?
Yeah. So I think in general, once we say an older patient who will not go for stem cell transplant, I think in our mind, we start saying, are they fit or unfit? And fitness is such an important thing because age is truly not, you know, the chronological age, but truly a biological age. So if they are fit and they're 70, I would absolutely say, give them the best deep response that you can do, which is three drug regimen better than two drug regimen. And here, at least we're doing the RVD light, but there are so many different options that can be done, including even carfilzomib at a lower dose in some of those patients. If the patient is not fit, then here I have to be careful with toxicity. And then two drugs like lenalidomide and dex is perfectly reasonable. And this is the first study, which was the big, large, randomized French study that showed a huge benefit with RD followed by maintenance with lenalidomide.
You know, I'm kind of curious because I hear from RVD people like you and many other people, particularly in Boston, that when you dose carefully and use, you know, RVD light or some variation of it, it really isn't any more difficult to get in than RD. So, I mean, why not use it in an older, frail patient? Is there really what is it that's the threat to them? Is it myelosuppression? Is it the corticosteroids?
Well, it starts adding up a little bit, but I agree with you. If we're careful and we know how to dose and, you know, take care of the toxicity profile of the patients, they usually tolerate very well RVD. One of the things that maybe for frail patients would be how often to come to clinic with a sub-Q bortezomib dosing when they come to clinic once a week at least, whether the thrombocytopenia would be too much for them, whether zoster reactivation would be too much for them. So those extra things with the neuropathy could be maybe a little bit more problematic for them. But I agree, in general, sub-Q bortezomib is a very easy, well-tolerated therapy for many of the patients, even frail patients.
So you mentioned the first study of RD that was presented, I guess, in ASH 2014. It really changed a lot of people's approach to older patients. But one thing about that study was that the arm that did well was really the people who got RD indefinitely or until progression. And we asked the audience, okay, in this 77-year-old, assuming that, let's say, RD is going to be used, how long would you use it for? And the majority of the audience, about two-thirds, said they would use it until disease progression or toxicity. Is that your approach?
Yeah, so I like to give the RD part as the induction exactly like they did, and then you cut down the lenalidomide. I usually remove the steroids because long-term steroids is what causes toxicity, and then we keep them on len maintenance alone. And yes, until progression is an excellent way for us to think about it right now, and it's based on that large phase 3 study. The first study shows you that maintenance lenalidomide gives you a longer progression-free survival in those patients.
Another question that we asked the audience and we discussed on the panel that relates to upfront therapy is the question of carfilzomib. Obviously, we've seen some encouraging data, but the question is, should it be used right now? And we actually asked the audience, you know, assuming there were no regulatory issues causing a problem, would you use carfilzomib as part of upfront treatment? About a third of the audience just said, yes, they would, and most of the time. But more of them said they'd use it, but in specific situations, for example, a patient with pre-existing neuropathy. Right now, today, first of all, can you access carfilzomib upfront? And secondly, do you think it's appropriate to use it?
So right now we have three proteasome inhibitors that are approved for myeloma: carfilzomib, bortezomib, and ixazomib. And I think there is room for all of them in upfront setting. Ixazomib right now is not approved for the upfront setting. And if you start thinking of whether I should use an RVD regimen versus a carfilzomib Revdex regimen, a KRD regimen, I in general would think that KRD gives us a depth of response that's deeper than RVD. I use it for my patients with high-risk cytogenetics. I use it for patients who are younger, potentially, who do not have any cardiac or pulmonary problems that I would be worried about. And I want to make sure that I achieve an MRD negative disease at a higher level compared to an RVD. I still use RVD as my main way of thinking for most of my patients, and I reserve KRD for the ones that I really want to get a depth of response or bad cytogenetics in them. Having said that, there are many other places, like in Chicago, with many other centers that would use KRD as their upfront regimen, and that's perfectly acceptable. And most of our insurances are covering it without any problems.
You know, it's interesting. It sounds like you feel that KRD or carfilzomib, you know, increases the activity, the anti-tumor activity. Why wouldn't you use it in everybody?
Yeah, so we don't know that for sure. We know from the Endeavor data that indeed carfilzomib versus bortezomib head-to-head in the relapse setting, there was definitely a difference between them, with carfilzomib giving us a better progression-free survival and depth of response. And you could potentially take that data and say that maybe when you add KRD versus RVD. However, there is no current data that says that for sure. And because of that, and because of the long experience we have with RVD, it's hard to say that indeed, yes, we will replace RVD with KRD.
You mentioned ixazomib, and maybe you comment a little bit on what we know about ixazomib, what we know about it up front, and whether or not there are any situations where you would utilize it up front.
Yeah, absolutely. So ixazomib is an oral proteasome inhibitor. It's the first FDA-approved proteasome inhibitor that's oral. It's basically like bortezomib in a way. And so the ixazomib data that we know so far, and especially in the upfront setting, is based on Shaji Kumar's data. This was presented about a year ago. And it shows that indeed, if you use ixazomib with len and dex, so an IRD regimen, you have a really high depth of response, VGPR that was high in those patients. And you can use ixazomib as maintenance therapy, which is for the first time we're using proteasome inhibitors in maintenance therapy in our patients.
So what about using it as part of upfront therapy? Kind of gets into the question when you have a drug that's in a similar class, but different, you know, I mean, I guess it's not exactly bortezomib, but, you know, how much data do you need in order to move it up into the upfront setting?
Yeah. So I think that ixazomib RD would probably be something that I would use in my patients that I want to replace bortezomib, and I don't want to bring them into the clinic for sub-Q bortezomib. So my elderly population, the same patient that we had said, maybe a frail patient, and I don't want to bring them to clinic yet, I want to get depth of response. I don't think that it would give us any deeper response than bortezomib. So here you're trying to just replace an oral versus an IV regimen. It has less neuropathy. It has different toxicity profile. I think it would be great for patients who don't want to come to clinic, who we don't have to give them IV drug, the elderly population, the patients who are working full-time and don't want to come 2 days a week to clinic.
Is there any indication that it, I mean, obviously we don't have great data or comparative data, but just indirectly or even your clinical experience, any indication whether ixazomib is less effective than bortezomib?
There is no, of course, head-to-head comparison. There is no data that says that. And I think in general, it looks very similar to bortezomib with a different toxicity profile.
So there were a couple other cases and questions related to upfront therapy that these docs had. One, any non-steroid-containing regimens for induction in patients with brittle diabetes?
So I think in general, the immunotherapies as well as the antibodies can be used without steroids. We use them as part of the pre-medication, but you don't have to continuously give them so much therapy with those agents. In general, steroids are used a lot in myeloma, absolutely. But in some cases, you can use less and less frequently the steroids and maybe use it upfront in the first few cycles, and then you can stop after that.
So another question, this is from Dr. Jason Malier. 60-year-old patient presents with plasma cell leukemia. The white count's 150,000. Initial therapy, allogeneic transplant,
So very hard question, and we don't have strong answers for plasma cell leukemia. We know that, again, being very aggressive with the treatment, I usually use Cytoxan, bortezomib, and dex, but you can also use four-drug regimens in that case, Cyborg-D plus lenalidomide. You can start adding antibodies in the future, so trying to give as much as you can upfront. In general, we can clear the plasma cells in the peripheral blood very fast. It's still the resistant bone marrow plasma cells that will cause refractory disease and will lead to relapse in those patients. But aggressive hydration and treatment immediately and not waiting and not just giving them Lendex or something like this, I would give them as aggressive treatment as I can in those patients. And the second part of it?
Allo transplant.
So that's a hard question. Again, we don't have a lot of new data for allotransplant in myeloma. There has been several studies that some have shown benefit, some did not really show benefit. And at the end of the day, we have decided in general as a community for myeloma to keep allo as part of clinical trials and not as a part of standard of care. There are a few exceptions, of course, very young patients, patients who we think that indeed they can benefit from a mini allo or a full allo in certain conditions. But in general, we don't do it as a routine for allo transplant for myeloma.
So Dr. Morgenstein presented another interesting case, a 62-year-old man with 414 who actually presented very sick, extensive bone disease, renal disease, hypercalcemia. He actually got induction with RVD, but he was curious about maintenance after transplant, which this man had. But what is your usual induction regimen with patients with adverse cytogenetics, including DEL19?
Yeah, so again, 414 translocation, usually proteasome inhibitors are very good for it. 17p deletion is probably one of our worst ones that we don't have very good benefit with many drugs. In general, again, RVD or KRD would be a very good combination upfront. I think KRD in some of the patients may give us a deeper response, although there is no strong data head-to-head, of course. And then I usually like to keep maintenance with a proteasome inhibitor along with lenalidomide. So the data of maintenance therapy with the CELGB study as well as the French study showed us that len maintenance versus placebo was better with len. However, in high-risk patients, high-risk cytogenetics, we like to keep the proteasome inhibitors ongoing. So Sagar Lonial had done a phase 2 study of sub-Q bortezomib every 2 weeks, along with lenalidomide. Now with ixazomib, and especially the Shaji Kumar data of ixazomib maintenance, and there are trials now of maintenance therapy with ixazomib showing indeed that you can use it, I think I would probably do either ixa or bortezomib maintenance continuous in those patients. Or if you've used carfilzomib upfront, of course, you can keep it as a carfilzomib maintenance in those patients.
You know, when I first started to hear investigators talking about using proteasome inhibitors as maintenance therapy, as I have been hearing now for quite a while, my first thought was, wow, this is going to be a lot better once we have an oral proteasome inhibitor. So it seems from a quality of life point of view, it's just going to make a gigantic difference. Have you started doing that, using ixazomib in maintenance setting?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the clinical trials, we had it ongoing already. And yes, absolutely. The one thing we want to make sure is if we used bortezomib upfront, can I switch to ixazomib for maintenance or not? And this is where we're starting now to get that sense from our patients. It's still early. We just got the approval for the ixazomib, so we don't have that many patients yet in the maintenance setting to go for that.
So another issue that was brought up by the group, and we actually polled the audience about this, is the patient who has a standard risk myeloma, the younger patient, gets triple therapy induction, gets a transplant, and goes into a complete response. And the question of maintenance therapy, when we asked the audience, and course, our audience there at ASH is, you know, pretty heterogeneous. There are a lot of international people, so I'm not sure how that affects it. But we had almost a third who would not use maintenance therapy in a patient with CR. Most of the rest would use lenalidomide. How do you think it through the use of maintenance based on response after transplant?
Yeah, so I think in general, I personally think that maintenance therapy should be used for everyone. What we don't know as an answer is which maintenance, len alone or len proteasome inhibitor or proteasome inhibitor alone, and for how long. However, there is a lot of data of progression-free survival benefit. Again, yes, not overall survival, but PFS benefit of len maintenance versus placebo. I think a CR is not enough anymore in myeloma. We're now talking about MRD negative disease. So a CR, there's definitely a lot of tumor cells left over there, and we know that those patients will benefit from maintenance therapy.
You mentioned MRD status, and again, I'm hearing more and more discussion about that. How far away are we, or are we in a situation now where it's reasonable to do some type of MRD measurement outside a trial setting?
Yeah, so there are two different methods for MRD that are currently available in myeloma, and hopefully more and more to come. And I'm not talking about imaging, which is the PET CT scan that's being used in some patients. There is the flow cytometry data, which is based on the Spanish way of doing it. It's a little bit complicated. I know the Spanish have developed this Euroflow. However, here in the US, it's very hard for people to follow up and do the Euroflow or the Spanish flow in all of the patients. Then there is, of course, the next generation sequencing method, which I think is easier to follow, but it has also its own problems, and this is based on trying to look for the VDJ rearrangement that you had in your patient with myeloma when he was diagnosed, and then go back and try to find the exact sequences that you have. So you're doing sequencing for those samples and trying to define if you still have leftover disease in the bone marrow of those patients.
So do you think this is ready for prime time right now in practice?
Yes, absolutely. And it's actually approved. So we can send it and it's insurance covered. And I do send it to many of my patients to actually look for MRD negative disease in those patients.
And is that mainly for prognostication, or are there any practical treatment related implications?
It's currently for prognosis. We know that from all of the studies that have been done so far that MRD negative disease gives us a better progression-free survival because you're achieving less tumor burden, of course, so they will not relapse as fast. In the future, we think that maybe that will help you in changing your way of treatment. Think if someone is MRD negative for 6 months apart, maybe they're cured, or 1 year apart. Someone who is MRD negative at first and then became positive, that's probably someone you want to add more maintenance therapy or add an immunotherapy or change your regimen for those patients. The future will come when we will be using MRD to change our therapy.
So another thing we were talking about is the role of any consolidation therapy after transplant. Any comments?
I don't do it routinely. There has been, of course, the studies of doing two cycles of RVD post-transplant or other therapies post-transplant as consolidation. I'm not a strong pushing for my regular practice for the consolidation. I feel sometimes patients post-transplant, it's too much toxicity for them to get the consolidation.
So we also asked the audience in terms of dosing of lenalidomide in the maintenance setting, both in the younger post-transplant situation as well as the older patient who, as you talked about, gets started on an initial dose and then goes into a lower dose for maintenance. What specific dose do you use in those two settings?
Yeah, I usually start with 15 or 10 milligrams, depending if the patient is frail or has already cytopenias or not. But I start with 15 and then we can lower it down to 10.
Where do you see things heading in the immediate future in terms of upfront treatment of myeloma?
So I think the future will be that we don't treat every patient the same way. Right now, we have so much understanding of the biology and we know that there is poor risk cytogenetics and 17p and 414. And then yet when we come to the treatment, we say, oh, everyone will get RVD followed by transplant, followed by maintenance. And the solid tumor people are much better than us in really doing precision medicine and really using their mutation status and the bad cytogenetics to tailor therapy a little bit better. I think we should get into a more precision medicine for myeloma. A 17p deletion patient should not be treated the same way like someone with standard risk cytogenetics. And here where we can use is the immunotherapies, the monoclonal antibodies, maybe start thinking of drugs that truly target the mutations that we have. So a BRAF mutation, maybe we would add to the RVD a BRAF inhibitor. So I think the future will be that we subdivide the patients a little bit and use a little bit the understanding of the clones and the clonal evolution that we have right now to maybe tailor therapy a little bit better.
You see BRAF mutations in myeloma?
Yes, 4% of the patients up front, and it will increase more as you relapse. There was data by Gareth Morgan presented this year on spatiotemporal analysis of the mutations that happen in patients with myeloma. And there was one very interesting case that they presented where the bone marrow had a very small clone of BRAF, while a plasmacytoma on the same patient had a huge clone of BRAF. And this is where you could potentially have benefit of BRAF inhibitors in those patients. As well as sequential samples, the clone of BRAF was increasing more and more.
These are V600E?
Yes, absolutely.
And have either BRAF inhibitors or BRAF inhibitors plus MEK inhibitors been used in myeloma?
There are trials ongoing right now. There are some of those basket trials where anyone with BRAF mutation can be included in them. The one thing to be careful about is it's not always clonal, and there are sometimes patients having other mutations with the BRAF. And we've seen, at least from some of the early studies in the lab and not in patients, if you use a BRAF inhibitor alone, the other clone that has KRAS or NRAS or something like this will grow much more. So you have to be careful of using combinations and not single agents in some of those patients.
So speaking of bringing concepts from other tumors into myeloma, any comments on the use of immunotherapy in myeloma, either checkpoint inhibitors or CAR-T?
Yeah, absolutely. So CAR-T, there was a New England Journal of Medicine presentation or a paper about one case that came from Pennsylvania, where they indeed saw a very long remission for a patient who had CAR-T therapy with the CD19 CAR-T. So this is, again, hard to understand how CD19 CAR-T will work in myeloma that's CD19 negative. There are lots of clinical trials ongoing now with the BCMA or other targets, other antigens for the CAR-T therapy in myeloma. So I think that by next year, we will have a lot of understanding of how to use CAR-T in myeloma. But even now, the CD19 data looks promising enough that there was a phase 2 study done with about 20 or 30 patients, and we're waiting to get all the results on those. As far as immune checkpoint inhibitors, there was some data presented this year with the PD-1 inhibitor plus lenalidomide showing about 70% response rate. So this is the pembro plus lenalidomide showing a 70% response rate. So again, lots of clinical trials are ongoing right now. And hopefully by next year in ASH, we will see a huge understanding again of the use of immune checkpoint inhibitors, especially in combination with immunomodulators.
Yeah, it's interesting. The idea of combining a checkpoint inhibitor with lenalidomide makes a lot of sense. What about elotuzumab? How do you conceptualize the mechanism of action there? I know it is related to the immune system.
Yeah, absolutely. So ELO works on several methods. One of them is NK cell activation. One of them is really tagging the myeloma cells through the SLAMF7, and then you can have a more immune response to that. We don't know exactly how it works very well. We're still trying to understand it more and more, but it's truly an immune regulator in myeloma.
So there was another case presented by the group. This is Dr. Lyle Feinstein's case. 68-year-old man, IgG, kappa myeloma, normal cytogenetics on FISH, has a complete remission to 7 cycles of RVD, gets a transplant, is in CR, but then at day 100 has relapsed. So the patient gets VCD but develops disease progression, gets carfilzomib, still has progression, goes on pomalidomide, and develops cutaneous nodules and chin numbness. Skin biopsy shows plasmacytoma, and lumbar puncture shows central nervous system involvement. So Dr. Feinstein's question was, how do you treat extramedullary disease, and how do you treat CNS disease?
Yeah. So these are the hardest cases, and unfortunately, this is how we're losing many patients to myeloma. And it's really at the end stages of the disease, we start having all of this extramedullary myeloma as well as CNS involvement. It's hard to know. I think, again, just extramedullary disease without CNS involvement. Here you can use drugs that you haven't used in this patient. And again, daratumumab in combination with something else would be wonderful in this patient. And here again, immunotherapy, immune checkpoint inhibitors, CAR-T would be wonderful for those patients. For those with CNS disease, again, we don't have a lot of drugs that cross the blood-brain barrier and can give us good responses. I think high-dose steroids would be good. Bendamustine, there is data that it does cross the blood-brain barrier and it works for myeloma. So I usually use it in those patients. We don't know, again, about the antibodies in this case. So it's hard to know what to do with those patients. But I usually go back to high-dose steroids and bendamustine as one of the options that I have.
So I want to finish out with your take on something every oncologist is asking about nowadays in myeloma, which is how to use the four drugs approved in the disease over the past year. And you commented earlier on the oral proteasome inhibitor exazimib. How about the monoclonal antibody elotuzumab? Can you describe an ideal clinical scenario where you'd use it?
Yeah, absolutely. A patient who like a Cyborg D upfront therapy and you now have him relapsing, you can absolutely use Elo-Len as a first relapse for that patient. A patient that you were on maintenance of lenalidomide at 5 milligrams or something and he's starting to progress, I would probably just increase the dose of Len and add Elo to it, and it would be an excellent way of giving this patient treatment. If we ever can use Elo upfront, I think for those elderly patients that we think for the first trial, like Lendex upfront, I think Elo-Lendex would be an amazing thing to give to those patients. So there is absolutely all of those different ways where you can think of Elo-Lendex as an excellent combination for those patients.
How about daratumumab? Can you just, again, describe a perfect patient?
I think Dara can be used in so many different things. You can use it Dara alone, Dara combination with bortezomib, Dara combination with Len in the relapse setting. And of course, in the future, we hope to get a Dara RVD or a Dara KRD as our dream upfront option for our patients, especially high-risk patients.
So, I mean, you described the patient who relapses on Len maintenance, and you suggested increasing the dose of Len and bringing in Elo. Instead of doing that, why wouldn't you either bring in Dara alone or Dara with Len?
You could, depending on the relapse of the patient. So if it's a mild relapse, it's easy to increase the dose of Len and add Elo to it. If it's someone going into a plasma cell leukemia or really aggressive sudden change where you don't think that the lenalidomide increase in the dose with Elo would be a good option for them, here's a switch of classes. You can do Dara plus bortezomib or Dara plus carfilzomib in this patient.
So the really tricky one to me is panobinostat. Maybe you can talk about the clinical scenario where you'd use that and how you use it.
So I would probably say, just because of the approval, pano plus bortezomib is a good option whenever you're thinking of bortezomib. And here, maybe the sub-Q, the once a week, is a good combination. There has been very nice data of using panobinostat plus lenalidomide, and it actually has less toxicity compared to when we used it with bortezomib. And the same holds true for pano with carfilzomib, where again, you have less toxicity compared to when we had it with bortezomib in heavily, heavily pretreated patients. I think in general, those patients would be those that can tolerate it without too much thrombocytopenia. And again, if we want something that would have an epigenetic regulation with a proteasome inhibitor, would be wonderful.
So Dr. Morgenstein actually presented a case, a 63-year-old patient who has had refractory to, quote, everything, who got a panobinostat and had a lot of GI toxicity. The patient had to be stopped. What's your experience specifically with GI toxicity and how do you manage it?
Yeah, so I think the most important thing is knowing about it and preemptively treating the patients or taking care of them before they start having, you know, 10 bowel movements and then you're dehydrated and then now you're trying to figure it out. We hydrate them well, we tell them about it, we make sure they have with them medications that can prevent the diarrhea, and they start taking it before they start having too many problems with this. And then those reductions are very important with panobinostat and giving them the time to recover, and then you can retreat again.